I have 3.5 minutes to talk about Bitcoin. That's fine. Shouldn't take much longer than 3.5 minutes. How many people here know enough about Bitcoin so we don't have to get too deeply buried in the basis of it? That's really good because, you know, like what usually happens is I go around talking to a lot of companies and you say, hey, you know, Bitcoin, it's really something you should pay attention to. And usually I get a blank stare. And usually everybody says, I don't know why I need to do that. And that makes me think that this is really important. Because I lived through this in 1995, when you would go around talking about the web and the internet and say, that's a really important thing, and Heineken would say to you, hey, look, I'm Heineken, I sell beer, I can't sell beer on the web, what the hell is this to me, you know? Or in Joey's case, someone will say, well, I know about the internet, that's so I can look up a website and see a camera aimed at a coffee maker. What does that have to do with me? So, you know, like all of these people, and I didn't have a good answer, by the way. I couldn't tell Heineken why it should get on the web in 1995, except that this was going to be the forum for a lot of other development, and therefore it was the ante. And I know you can't sell beer on the web, but maybe you ought to do it. Well, I'm beginning to think that Bitcoin is relevant like that. But I'm not only going to talk about Bitcoin, although I will dwell on it. In the laboratory here, we have something we call the Digital Currency Initiative. And the Digital Currency Initiative is actually focused on more than Bitcoin. It's focused on many other manifestations of digital currency and the supporting elements or the byproducts thereof. The problem is no one can talk about that without talking about Bitcoin because it's the elephant in the room. There's, you know, $1.3 billion of coinage out there today, slightly more because it's a little bit up from when I calculated that number. And there's $800 million in venture capital going to people investing in the technology of Bitcoin and the blockchain that backs it up itself. But if you look at what you really could be looking at, then this is my own chart. This is not necessarily representative of what others in the laboratory, how they would parse the problem. But in my own, there's two things to look at, and one of them is the financial side, and the other is the contract side. But first, let me reiterate the one thing that sort of is true, although when Dave Oran was here at the last meeting, we had some argument about it, and that is that what Bitcoin fundamentally is it an example of what's called a trustless or fully distributed system. And that is to say it has no central node, no central authority. It exists without the requirement that any one party trust any other party, and that's the fundamental basis for it. And in that network is stored a time-stamped, irrevocable ledger of every transaction that has ever occurred. And those two words are the most important part once you get past the distributed part, and that is to say that it is time-stamped and irrevocable. So what's put into this blockchain is publicly accessible and irrevocable. That's what it's about, and that's what people are talking about for a lot of reasons, because that has a lot of implications and potentials. So if you look down the financial side and say maybe this is a good way to replace money, then that forks or splits into two leaves, and one of them is Bitcoin, which is the big one, and the other is other. And that is to say, there are other forms of digital currency. They don't have to be Bitcoin. There are other ones that are out there traded now. Our group used to mine some of them. I don't even know if they still exist. We were already up to being able to buy like at least a half a gallon of ice cream from our mining efforts. And for all I know, that could have melted or evaporated since then. But in any case, you can do it. It's interesting, of course, that the reason we're even thinking about this is because for the last 5 or 6 years, the blockchain has survived unattacked. And so in one way of looking at it is this trustless, distributed, irrevocable ledger has persisted unbreakably for 5 years, and that's important. As Oran would say, that means it's failed because it's only lasted 5 years. But I think we can say that we don't know that there's a failure in its future, so I'd call that a success. That's the reason we're talking about it, because the ledger has existed. When you get into the ledger, then you get into some of the more complicated and weird aspects of Bitcoin. And I'm not speaking here as a booster. I'm speaking here as just someone who's going to talk about it. And I'll lay out my own questions about how it works. But the Bitcoin blockchain itself is what I'm going to call a ledger that's open and public. And that is to say, everyone has access to it. There's a group of people called miners that maintain it, but anybody can be a miner. these days, anyone who has a lot of money can be a miner, but we're building an effort that you'll see in a while that actually is a pretty cheap effort. Haven't made a lot of money with it yet, but nevertheless, anyone can be a miner, so it's an open and a public ledger. Doesn't have to be that way. You can have ledgers that are permission-based. You can have private blockchains and use that protocol and that algorithm and run your own ledger. I'll give you an example of one, which I heard about at a workshop some months ago, and that is, imagine you're a company and you want to put your general ledger, every transaction you make in your company, into a irrevocable, readable, verifiable, unalterable ledger. That's a good thing for simple, straightforward stuff like accounting. Well, you might have a blockchain that is that ledger, indeed, and that blockchain is maintained by five parties: Deloitte, Ernst & Young, PricewaterhouseCoopers, whoever the fourth big accounting firm is, Pete Marwick, and the IRS, because that's the reason you're maintaining an accounting system with those guys. Well, you already trust those people, okay? So you could build that private ledger. The trust would be distributed among those five trusted parties. Some of the overhead associated with a public ledger would therefore be gone, and you could indeed do that. Now, you might also want to do that for medical records. You might also want to do that for permissions of any, you might want to do it if you're MIT in order to maintain a ledger by which you grant people degrees and they could verifiably and in a guaranteed way prove that they got the degree from MIT and also prove that it couldn't be enforced. So that's my view of what the sort of Bitcoin universe is. Now, the odd thing is, I think these are somewhat out of order. Let's look at under the hood a little bit and see how some of this stuff actually works, and then you can decide whether it might be a good idea for some things and not others. And I'll get, at the end, I'll close with what I think are important things that we are going to work on related to it. But if you look at two types of currency, I've got a chart there. Look vertically. There's two columns there for what I think of as currency, and the column on the left is gold, and it's been used as currency before, as has copper and silver and all that kind of happy stuff historically. When you find gold or mine gold, you expend energy to find gold, and the result of expending that energy is you end up with something of inherent value, the gold itself. You could say the same thing about coal. You can argue about the inherent value of gold. I don't want to argue about the inherent value of gold. I've got 5,000 years of history behind me that says gold has inherent value, because for 5,000 years people have kind of imputed some value for it and indeed used it as a money because it meets some of the criteria of money, and that is to say it's rare, it's useless, and it's highly valued. So, you know, those, you can't make money out of stuff that's useful. Like, America was on the tobacco standard for longer than it was on the gold standard, but the problem is you would consume your own money, you know, and so you avoid using it, making money out of stuff. So anyway, that's the gold story. Down the other side of the thing, there's what we call fiduciary currencies, and those currencies take nothing to create. It costs 5 cents to create a $20 bill in the United States. It costs 18 cents to create a $100 bill because it has a little bit more security in it. But what you end up with is something that has no inherent value. You end up with a piece of paper that's backed by the fiduciary responsibility of the government. Now, the people in the Bitcoin world don't use that word fiduciary. They use the word fiat. They call gold, dollars, a fiat currency. And the reason they use that word is because fiat is something you can spit out in a very derogatory way. So that's a fiat currency, is if it's no good. Since 1853, the United States has granted the redemption rights on all paper money ever printed in the United States, since 1853, and it has never defaulted on that. So for 165 years, that fiat currency, spitting it out as I am, has held its value, and indeed, I have and my house, a $500 bill, which is no longer allowed to be used in circulation, and the United States government will give me $500 for it. As a coin collector, it's worth about $600. But the United States, it has a floor. It will always be worth $500. But nevertheless, that's the way it works. Now, so those are the two kinds of money. Now, when you get to Bitcoin, it gets kind of funny, because Bitcoin slices through that chart diagonally in a really funny way. And that is to say, it takes a lot of energy, but what you've created is something of no inherent value. You've created a Bitcoin, not a lump of coal or not any gold. Now, when I say takes a lot of energy, what does that mean? Well, the natural cost of creating a block on the blockchain these days is approximately, the equilibrium cost is $6,000. And we create one every 10 minutes, okay? And the reason is because a miner gets a reward of minting 25 bitcoins. That number used to be 50, it went down once to 25, and a few years it'll go down to 12. But currently you get 25 bitcoin for mining that block. And at the current rates of exchange, that's worth a little more than $6,000. Now, if it cost more than $6,000 to mine that coins and to make that block, then no one would do it. That's not exactly true. Speculators would still do it because they're betting on the future value of the 25 coins that they therefore obtain. But nevertheless, it's still approximately $6,000. And if it costs much, much less, then everybody would do it. And my lab downstairs would have more than a melted gallon of ice cream to show for all of our mining efforts. So the equilibrium cost is about $6,000. There's a block created every 10 minutes. That's $36,000. A year, an hour, which works out to 1.4 terawatt hours per year of energy burned up to do nothing but create things that have no value. Okay? Not even the federal government behind them. Now, that's not very green. Okay? In fact, if you walked up to me this morning and said, Andy, I have a new idea for a currency, we're just going to burn up 1.4 terawatt hours per year and build computer centers that can do nothing useful, almost, except mine bitcoins, you'd say, and I've been fighting for all these years over, like, Cape Wind and, you know, solar here and all this kind of good stuff there. I mean, I thought the word of today was sustainability. But it gets worse. No, it doesn't get worse. It gets only slightly worse. There is a transaction fee. First of all, by the way, don't take my numbers to the bank, if you can find a bank. They're not exactly right. We are now becoming good friends with a relatively important miner, and he and his buddies together control 60% of the mining power associated with Bitcoin. He has several, you know, megawatt computing centers that he's running. It turns out there's a quirk in the law in China, and that is if you cite a computer facility or anything, if you site anything on the site of a hydroelectric plant, you can have all the power you want for free, and he's done that. So he's got a data center at a hydroelectric plant in China. Other people put them in places where it's cold, and so you can get the cooling for free and all that kind of stuff. That does not save any electricity, as you would all know, because as Bill will tell you, it's all about opportunity cost. If you burn your own energy solar, that's a whole lot of solar energy that's not being used for a productive purpose and, you know, coming from coal. So it's a displacement, it's not a saving, so that's a lot of junk. But nevertheless, 50% of his cost almost is in the physical hardware. So it's really actually only $3,000 of electricity every 10 minutes to do this, but that still computes to the 1.4 terawatts. There are transactions, and there's transaction fees associated with it. Eventually, we'll reach a time when there are no more Bitcoin, but that won't happen until 2115 or some oddball number like that, when I won't have to worry about how much money I don't have. And then all the money, all the support for that computational power has to come from the transactions. This looks pretty complicated, and it is. It demonstrates what's really going on here. So what is really going on here? Well, a whole lot of people have written papers about it, and so here's a compendium of you know, that we did a few months ago of all the academic papers people do, and 26% of them are about economics, 26% about transfers, you know, some are about smart contracts, and some are about that, some are about stability, security, and privacy. So, you know, what have we got? What we've got is we've got this thing that's a currency combined with this remarkable ledger capability, and my sense of what's sort of really going on is two things, and one of them is my takeaway from this is Bitcoin is a political move. It's not a financial move, okay? And that is to say, it's driven by a libertarian ethos that says we must not have a government involved in our exchange of value, okay? That we can't, and we will burn as much energy as it takes to build a system that will be robust without having a trusted guarantor like a government. That, to me, is a political statement, not an economic statement. But what it's done is the fact that it works and has this money associated with it, and it is somewhere between tulips and reality. I'm not saying it isn't all going to explode and turn to tulips and, you know, in a week like happened to the Dutch, but it is, it's got a certain amount of energy and stuff behind. I mean, just to give you an example, the reason you did all this ledger crap was because you want to avoid this double spending problem. That's the fundamental problem of a digital currency. And the proof of work, that is the principle that makes the blockchain work, which is deliberately and by necessity, by the way, it's not accidental, it has to be this way, is providing no useful output. In other words, the energy is not being used to grow rice for the poor and can't. If you did grow rice for the poor, then you would have to add useless energy on top of it in order to actually differentiate. So it turns out it's fundamentally required that it be useless. That's simply there to maintain that distributed nature of it and to make sure that people can't cheat. But people worried about a 51% attack back in the old days. They worried that, oh, if 51% of the miners colluded, then they could redo transactions, double spend, alter transactions and the like. Turns out the opposite is the case. Our friend who, you know, represents 60% among his friends, well, in July, they had a little problem with Bitcoin. They switched from version 0.7 to version 0.8. Didn't work. The blockchain divided. There were two records of transactions that were different, and they called each other up on the phone and reconciled them because they don't want their investment in their data centers to be rendered worthless. So it's really more like a 50% anti-attack. It's a 50% defense rather than a 50% attack. That's what's going on in the world of miners. So you sort of have to think about some of those kinds of things associated with it. So anyway, that's sort of, you know, some of the odd things that are going on. Now, people are talking about and why you should be interested in it. This is what I couldn't tell Heineken 20 years ago when we first started thinking about it from the web. There's a lot of research going on in this area, although I wouldn't call it research. It's sort of venture-backed attempted startups, as I said, from everything to healthcare to automated contracts using the blockchain. Now, one of the things that people do consider and contemplate with that and are is, for example, rights management. If you want to present a narrative film or program in one country and suddenly it catches on in Australia, then you don't necessarily want to go through a 2.5-year negotiation in order to get the broadcast or delivery rights for that in Australia. So you might want to use some kind of public, irrevocable, automated contract to distribute and control the way rights are used. So that may or may not work. And it may be the kind of thing that you can't get to from here because that industry has a lot of legacy contracts that are hard to change, and it has a lot of legal implications that, you know, a computational mechanism may not be able to substitute for, but it has certain kinds of attractive advantages associated with it. Likewise, if I want to sell you a ticket to something, then there's no reason why I can't associate that sale of the ticket with a billionth of a Bitcoin, a tiny amount of money, put it on the blockchain, and then you can verify to the garden downtown that the scalper who sold you the ticket sold only one copy of that ticket, and indeed the ticket is valid. So these are perfectly reasonable. So you've got the Deloitte one, you've got the other. Now, in the case of the accounting example that I mentioned to you before, that's a blockchain maintained by trusted parties, and so therefore maybe doesn't have to have the mandatory, expensive proof-of-work algorithm maintaining it. Maybe it doesn't, but maybe it does. Because if it has that proof-of-work behind it, then and does waste that energy in return, then that makes it proportionately immune to attack from a third party. So it's not that you don't trust Deloitte, or you don't trust PwC, or you don't trust the IRS. It's that you don't trust that their machines and their networks are immune from a third-party attack. But a third party can't assault that blockchain if it's maintained with a sufficiently complicated and energy-intensive proof of work, because you can't catch up to the people who are maintaining it properly unless you have more energy than they do. And the odds are against that. Or you can make that arbitrarily hard, which is exactly what Bitcoin does, makes it arbitrarily hard, so no one can do that. So the mechanics and mechanisms are in place. Notice what I've just told you there. You now have a balance of security and energy. So when I said $6,000 an hour didn't sound very green, well, how much are you paying for your security and who are you paying it to? And it may be that the amount of money that you decide to pay, because you don't have to use that complicated a proof of work algorithm, is actually worth it. So what sounds like a bizarre thing may or may not be worth it. We're particularly interested in this from the perspective of people who are unbanked. And if you're unbanked, a disadvantage is that you have to have an account to use Bitcoin now. So I suggested, proposing this to the chairman of the FCC, in Lipman's world, I said, I'm not lobbying you, I'm not making a real proposal, I'm just describing you what Lipman's world is like. Wouldn't it be nice if people could use a mobile device without an account? Now, you can today. You can go buy this phone in any store and it'll dial 911, no account required. Well, you could make an ordered list of services, at the top of which might be watching Netflix, and at the bottom of which is 911, and you could draw the line as to which ones of those are mandatory to implement, in, like Amber's Law, for example, or those Amber Alerts, and not have an account. And that's an interesting point, because now maybe we're using money as a way to get to the point where access to the internet becomes not a first world prerogative problem of how many gigabytes I'm going to have at home and whether a network provider can verify that he's giving me that gigabyte, but for the few bytes that it takes to call for help or to spend money or to be part of the economic system when you don't have a home or a bank account, you may be able to do with the internet as that kind of right. So that's why we think about Bitcoin.
Has anybody done any work on workless, secure blockchains? So presumably there must be cryptographic techniques you can use to produce a very robust chain without needing to base it on energy that's also being used to modulate the liquidity of the system.
So one thought, obviously this Bitcoin has tremendous potential for the unbanked. But a couple of sort of associated problems, and I wonder if you have seen any work on it or have thoughts about it. And these are, you know, most people who are unbanked in very poor places are also unidentified. So they have no identity, I mean, formal identity, most of them. And also, they are in a setting where the law enforcement is very poor as well. And so then one has to rely upon some kind of institutional arrangements so that these problems can be overcome. Something similar to, although not exactly identical, but something similar to, say, microfinance, Grameen Bank, which is an alternate mechanism to guarantee these things. Any thoughts on that?
Well, there's, of course, Tesla, you know, which has been used. And Tesla is run by Capital.com and the brand of Vodafone Corporation, was how it started, and now it's for profit. And it was used for essentially remittances across Kenya. And it's migrated to lots of other places, specifically because the banking system didn't work. And it's evolved to become a bank. So those problems are actually reasonably solvable. Stellar is another issue.
You mentioned at the beginning of your talk that David Oran disagreed with something about how you characterized the system. I was wondering, could you quickly summarize where he disagreed with you? I was lacking imagination.
It was just one of Dave's clever observations, and that is to say that the blockchain